In spite of perhaps 50 years of fairly settled results of Old Testament scholarship, in spite of many, many sermons and many, many books, I still find people asking this kind of questions about the opening chapters of Genesis that were being asked at the time of Charles Darwin when he put the cat among the pigeons with his evolutionary theory. He did the church a service, in a sense, by making people look more critically at this first book of the Bible to ask what sort of book it was and what it was meant to do. Forgive me if this is all old hat for you and you know it all so well. As I say, I still find people confused about it. Genesis is not the work of one author, most certainly not the work of Moses, to whom the editors of the 1611 Bible transcribed it. Most scholars think it's made up of at least four major documents to which they give the titles J, E, D, and P, for reasons I'm not going to explain. There are other documents embedded in it also, but it was not put together in its present form until perhaps getting on for 500 BC. The earliest document, J, which is of course still older in its older oral forms, was first written in the 9th century BC. The last one was written during the time of the exile in Babylon, perhaps 55 BC or a bit later. And it's from this most recent part that the account of creation with which Genesis opens is taken. The second account, the Adam and Eve account, is from the oldest of the sources. So just because it's at the beginning of the first book, we mustn't be fooled. It's one of the last of the Old Testament books to be written. It conflicts quite considerably with the earlier story in chapter 2. That didn't seem to worry the Jewish compilers, and I don't see why it should worry us. It's not a scientific book, a handbook for archaeologists and anthropologists. It's a story. It gets called technically a myth. Now, that's a word that gets misunderstood. It doesn't mean to say when you call something a myth that it's a pack of lies. It's a story, no doubt some fact and some fantasy, which is there to give us some understanding of the big questions about life. All sorts of peoples have produced their myths. They're not legends about historical people, but real stories invented about people who never existed, to tell some truth which is absolutely true. As long ago as 1923, somebody put it like this: it's a story to answer scientific questions in an age before science, or to answer historical questions in an age when there was no history. That's a bit rough and ready, but it gets us thinking along the right lines. The problems with Genesis arise only when we don't see what is myth and what is not, or when we ask a non-scientific book to answer scientific questions. There are some curiously accurate scientific facts written before men had the knowledge about these things. Some have argued that this means we must take the whole thing literally, but that's jumping to very large conclusions. The order of creation appears to be vaguely the same as the order the scientists now tell us is correct. But it also follows the importance of various living things, which would have been the way in which people in the 6th century BC thought. There are three kinds of questions we might want to ask about creation, to which we would require three distinct replies. We may well want to ask questions about the scientific origin of things. We'll need to go back to the origins of man, the evolution of mammals, back to protozoic life in the sea, back to the origin of the Earth, the origin of the Sun, our galaxy, and so on. And these are important questions. We're only just beginning to understand the complexity of the universe as we have so far discovered it. Scientists can only keep going back from one cause to another. It will press towards an ultimate cause of things, but it can never reach it, because a genuinely ultimate cause has no antecedents, nothing to relate to, and the scientist is only exploring these relationships. That's the scientific question about origin. Then there is a really real one there in the philosophical or metaphysical question. Is there anything that binds all creation together? In people, plants, rocks, stars, whatever your name, is there anything which unites, something from which they can all be said to come from? As someone has put it, is there a centre of things? And if so, what is it? People of all sorts of faiths and none can and should be searching for the answer to this kind of question. We all do it in a naive kind of way when we talk about nature as some kind of binding principle. That's the philosophical question. But the third is the nitty-gritty. even if we explore some answers to the first two, this one will still face us very clearly. We don't stand outside creation looking in, we're part and parcel of it. So we are bound to ask, how do we fit in? What's the point of it all? Is there any sense and purpose in creation? Or is it just some vast accident? What's the point of my being here? I don't want to know how I came to be, but why? If there is a creator, what's the relationship with him? Is he in charge now? Does he care about me? These are the religious questions. And ultimately, they have to be faced. The philosopher Gilbert Ryle said that if the day comes and all the questions of physics are answered, what we shall have discovered is that not all questions are questions of physics. You can look at a game of snooker, for example, in a cold scientific way. The balls on the table will behave according to the exact rules of mechanics. But however accurately you describe them, it will not be a satisfactory account of a game of snooker, because to do that you also have to take into account the player, the strategy of the play. You can account scientifically for why the various balls move as they do, but why they are made to make these movements is beyond science to answer. It lies in the mind of the player. And the analogy is simple enough. When we look at creation, we ask the question why, not the question how. It was that question which engaged the minds of those who formulated the mythological answers that we read in Genesis. And their answers remain valid for us today. They say, in the beginning, God. The ultimate source of life is not a principle or a force, but a personality. St. John put it even more forcibly in the Gospel. In the beginning was the Word, the creative will of God. And both Genesis and John say together that creation is God's love expressed. It involves us in it. It affirms the power and supremacy of the Creator. It affirms that creation was purposive. It affirms that in spite of all our difficulties, we are part of God's purpose. Our life has a meaning when we relate it to Him. We are born not of the will of man, but of God Himself. He has given us power to become the sons of God. That's the purpose. Jesus said He came to bring us life in its fullness. The mystery of Genesis, the beginning of things, is the God who created from nothing did so for a purpose, and that purpose includes you and me. And we come here to be identified with that purpose. The heavens proclaim the glory of God, says the psalmist. John said of Jesus, we saw His glory, the glory that is of the only Son of the Father, and we will pray that we may live and work to His praise and glory. The writer of Genesis said we were made in God's image. Jesus reaffirmed it with His talk of being sons of God, and we come to accept that privileged status in creation when we come to communion.